Topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information. And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services, high-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
All about financial planning, 131873 is our number. Ian Tonkinson, Chris Maliki from IT Financial Services. How are you, gentlemen?
Very well indeed.
Good morning. To see you again.
Indeed, yes, good to see you.
I hear that Goldman Sachs predicts a 1 in 3 chance for a recession for Australia next year.
Yeah,
what do you reckon?
Saw that in the paper, so they're talking about the growth slowing down in the economy and the mining sector slowing down, and Australia needs to pick up in some other area, otherwise we're in good, a 30% chance of going into a recession. So they've got to pick up in...
I think one-sixth of our action is in real estate.
Yeah, yeah.
The wealthy Chinese buying real estate is keeping us going.
And they said that's slowing down a little bit, and if that doesn't keep on going up, then there's a bigger chance. We're just going to find the growth from somewhere.
How hard have we been advertising it? Well, by we, I mean the real estate agents.
Advertising you know, the...
The real estate, come to Australia, buy real estate.
I think they've made a big industry of it. People directly going over to China and trying to get the Chinese investors. It's hard for them to move the money out, but they're finding a way to move it back over to Australia.
Right.
They see it as a safer investment.
Right. So if we cranked up the advertising a bit, you might get a bit more.
Yeah.
To at the expense of the first home buyers here.
Exactly. But for the people that have got a house, it's good for them because it's boosting up their house prices, but it's just harder for the kids to get in.
I can remember 50, 60 years ago, cars came with camping bodies. You could fold the seat down, the whole thing became one great big mattress. They will come back. You know, somewhere to live while you're looking for cheap accommodation. Yeah. And I saw something last week about Barangaroo. Super-duper luxury hotel, casino complex and all that sort of thing. But, oh, shock, horror, they hadn't allowed any affordable housing in it. Did that come as a surprise?
Did you see the first block of units down there? They sold off the plan, and there are 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units. And basically they went immediately on that day to at 1 million, 2 million, and 3 million, depending on the number of bedrooms.
Wow.
And they sold... In a jiffy. It's quite amazing.
It's like a Ferrari. If you have to ask how much, you can't afford it.
Probably right too.
Tick, tick, tick. Put me down for half a dozen. Yeah. 131873 for those who have questions about their finances, their financial planning, superannuation, do-it-yourself super, not do-it-yourself super, pensions, and annuities. Now, if I had $100,000 to put into shares or into some solid, secure account, why would I be advised in some circumstances to make it into an annuity where it trickles back to me as if it were a pension?
Well, with an annuity, it's very safe and it gives you the longevity. So the government's actually looking into it as well. They're putting some stuff together where, because people actually, if you've got $100,000, some people go out and buy a brand new car and they don't really save it for the future. But with an annuity, it's kind of setting you out. So you've got it for the next 15, 20 years. Could be a lifetime annuity where it just pays you that regular income.
Does it prevent you from reaching in and grabbing it all and rushing off to the Melbourne Cup?
Absolutely. You can't get it back.
Right.
And
if you die early, they get to keep the rest of it.
Yes, and if you live longer than you should, you get a better deal than you would have otherwise.
So they want to see a full medical report before they do this?
No, they don't want to say full medical report. They kind of do it on the averages. So a 65-year-old might have 25 years to live. So they'll pay you out. They'll kind of work it out 20 years. So it's obviously in their favour. So they make some money on it. And then they'll pay you out. And if you go over to 80, 90, 100 years old, then you've won. You've beat the insurance.
I see.
It's kind of like an insurance policy.
So if you live a bit older than the average.
Yes.
They're betting that's going to be kind of average.
But if you fall off the perch early, then they win big time.
One of the other problems, of course, is the rates that they pay you are based on long-term interest and bond rates.
Yes.
And at the moment, those are quite historically low. So the return you're actually getting on your annuity, and that's what you're locked into, it doesn't change when interest rates change, that can expose you later on. While Chris rightly said that they're a very low-risk investment, if you're getting, say, an interest rate return or the equivalent of, say, 4 or 5% return on the thing, and rates go back to where they were in 1990 at 17 or 18%, and inflation's up there somewhere, then you're a long, long way behind.
And the annuity provider has won.
Mm.
Or is winning. What if it's husband and wife that do this? One dies, the other one doesn't.
You can have a. You can also
the annuity still pay out.
Just depends on the type of annuity.
They've got
all sorts of different features depending on what.
What's the most attractive feature of it? The fact you've got savings that you can't reach in and grab, a bit like super back in the days when you had super.
Yeah, so it's something in there where it's you don't have to worry about it. It's there. It's done. Once you put it in place, you don't have to worry about it. It's going to pay you out. There's also fixed term annuity, so you don't if you live longer. So just they might pay you out for 20 years, and you can have a capital value at the end of it. So just say you put 100,000 in, and you just want to take the interest out each year.
Mm-hmm.
After 20 years, they'll give you they could give you $100,000 back, or whatever you kind of pick. You could say $50,000, and you're just drawing a little bit out extra.
And what kind of calculator do you need to work out who provides you the best deal for annuities?
There's not too many companies out there that offer them at the moment. So there's a few. So we go. You go onto the website. There's Commonwealth and Challenger, I think, the main players in the Australian market at the moment. A lot of them gave them up, a lot of the big providers, because they didn't find them as profitable running these small annuity things. So we go and have a look at a few of the annuities, but they're not as competitive these days as they were maybe 10 years ago.
Most importantly, do they see you coming? It's like a car on the lot with no price on it, and they see someone coming and knows nothing about cars. Hey, put another nought on the end for this one. Do they do that? Or is it in the brochure? This is what we have, sir.
It's all pretty set in concrete.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, I have to ask that question.
Yeah.
Because people are used to being ripped off when someone's trying to sell them something.
Yeah.
There used to be a lot of commissions in them, but now they've stripped all the commissions out, and it's purely fee-for-service based. So before, an advisor could get a lot of commission out of it, which we haven't done for forever type of thing, but it was a big problem at one stage.
Right. For those who just tuned in, this has nothing to do with FIFA. It's all above board, right?
Yes.
You said FIFA service. I thought, it's almost 14 past 12. 131873 is our number if you have any questions about organising your finances for retirement. And that, of course, is where IT Financial Services can come in and help you, because they've had so much experience helping thousands of people over the years. Do you have a questionnaire for people to fill in? What happens?
The diabolical, the questionnaires, but there are all sorts of legal responsibilities and so on that we have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get started tonight, I thought, into the normal topics, I thought it'd be just a quick comment on the refugee situation, which seems to be making the news every minute of every day, and how we're taking 12,000 new Syrian migrants or whatever. The one side that seems basically forgotten in all of this to me is that, well, have a look at Germany, for example, who are taking in 900,000 this year, or some ridiculous number like that, a huge number of migrants. Why are they doing it? It's not all humanitarian and goodness. Germany would have the same problem as Australia has. We've got a rapidly ageing population.
Uh-huh.
The number of people that are going to be around to pay tax in the future to look after the elderly people who retire and live off the system is diminishing all the time. If most of us are too young to remember it, but if you go back to the late 40s in Australia and the Snowy Mountain scheme, all that sort of thing, the migratory system we used then is what made this country great. And that's what grew, that the country grew off that migratory wave after World War II. And quite frankly, we really do need to be importing younger migrants. We need people that are going to come in and be actively in the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. So I think people are probably that are worried about the idea of 12,000 new people coming are probably not on the right track. I think we really do need to be developing our ability to bring people in here, particularly when we can get some skilled people as well.
But Canada knocked back the Chinese after a while because they're bringing their grandparents over, putting them in the hospital's public health system, and they thought, we can't afford to do this because collectively we consume more than we produce. We wouldn't be in such debt of, what, 45 grand apiece. So if you do find a highly skilled person that can work on Snowy Mountains Mark II, some great project, he's got his wife, he's got ex-children, he's got his grandparents, perhaps. Is he really going to produce enough to carry all those?
Well, if he's got the wife and the children, yes. And it's going to be, it'll be continued through various generations. So I think overall, I see what you mean about the grandparent thing, then again, you can legislate around that. You can restrict the benefits that you give to non-participants in the workforce. But the idea of the migrants and their kids coming. I think that's, we really do need that if the country is going to continue to grow and to be able to survive the ageing population that we undoubtedly are going to have problems with.
Well, Europeans for a long while haven't had growth economies. They've had steady state populations compared with ours. And we've had a housing industry that can take a politician out to lunch and say, mate, got to bring more people in, because if I have to sack all my builders and carpenters and bricklayers, then there's going to be a cascade of bankruptcies, and you'll be the people responsible for the next depression. And the police say, how many do you want? And that's why we have immigration. Germany's just about to discover they will become dependent upon growth. They'll build up a housing industry that obviously they don't have at the moment, because everyone has a roof over their head up until now. But if they're going to build enough houses for 1 million people or 500,000 a year or something like that, if the refugees slow to a trickle, they'll be knocking on the parliamentarians' doors saying, hey, got to sack all these people unless you bring some more people in. This is my prediction. They will get addicted to what we've been addicted to.
Yeah, I can hear the sense of what you're saying, yes, but I still don't see how we can avoid it, to be quite honest. I think we have to go in that direction.
How do we profit out of that then?
Well, just the knock-on effects. I mean, you just mentioned
the
housing for 500,000 people.
Yeah.
All of those people need their lounge suites and their TVs and their fridges and their washing machines, et cetera, et cetera. And so you do generate a lot of economic growth and knock-on effects by doing that.
The catch, of course, is the economists regard a disaster that knocks a lot of houses down as good for growth, because someone's got to rebuild the houses, even though at the end of the year you don't have any more than you had at the start. But they say, look at the GDP, there's growth. If we live next door and I do your cooking and you mow my lawn, hey, stuff's happening. But if we have to pay tax on the transaction, or if we live a valley away from one another and there's a middleman who takes goods between my place and yours, he naturally wants to do lots of trading. That's where the big money is.
Yes.
But before you know it, we're paying the government. We're doing things for someone else that they could probably do for themselves. This is in miniature what the world trade thing is like. And we just got to cop it sweet.
Well, I don't think we've got too many choices. The ageing population is what it is. And I don't think there's any other way around that.
Automation? They tell us automation will take most of the jobs. It should have taken the teacher's jobs 50 years ago, and I'm not joking about that. The world's best lectures on a DVD. It was better than a crook lecturer coming in hungover and giving you a bad lecture.
I was a teacher when I was young. I'm very sensitive about that comment.
In 1969, some of the lectures in Science 1 were big black and white television sets with gigantic reel-to-reel videotapes.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, this is the picture of tomorrow. Instead of hiring a lecturer, they just played the videotape of somebody else's lecture. That was 1969, nearly half a century ago. And since then, they're still employing as many teachers per head of student population. So somehow the teachers have held that part of the revolution at bay, while the rest of us look down the barrel of automation.
In fact, that ratio has probably increased. Teacher per student, I think, because classes have definitely got smaller since 1969.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. So, will we do some financial planning things now?
Right, let's take some calls on 131873. 131873. G'day, Robert.
Yes, hello there.
Hi there.
Yes, look, what I'd like to speak in relation to is the self-managed superannuation fund.
Yep.
I noticed some years ago in 2008, 9, 10, 11, the Labor Party reduced the minimum amount that you had to take by half, whereas at the moment we've got a lot of problems with the stock exchange, the fixed term rates and everything, and yet a person, say, on 65 to 74, has to draw down a minimum of 5% of his capital each year.
Yep.
Now, as I say, the Labor Party in those years reduced it to half. If the Liberal Party keeps it up to 5%, the way I see it, a lot of people on their self-managed superannuation funds will be definitely eating into their capital quite substantially.
You'd be very disappointed, actually, at that 5% rate to be eating into your capital. Having said that, the government have every intention that you will eat into your capital over a period of time.
Why was it that it was reduced to half?
It was to do with it was just because of the global financial crisis in 2009.
Yeah, but this year, if we look at the stock exchange, for the financial year, it's down at least 10%.
No, it's not.
What's it down?
No, probably not at all. You know, would have now you pick particular sectors that are down, such as the mining sector, but a lot of the overall return for most of our clients at for the last financial year was positive, but very, very narrowly positive. It certainly wasn't a good year. We did some statistics for one of our clients about a week ago on this, because he's very concerned because he virtually made no money for the 12 months, but the previous 2 years he'd made 21% and 14.5%. So you're going to get years like that, but if you look at the average over time, you'd be very disappointed not to do better than 5%.
Yeah. So what I'm saying, if you don't do at least 5%, you have to eat into your capital. Is that correct?
Yep. Don't forget, it's not just until you're 75. As you get older and older, that percentage you have to take each year grows and grows.
Yes, I noticed it goes from 4% up to 14%.
Yeah, 95 plus, you're taking 14%
That's
out
correct,
each year.
Yeah.
So the government really don't want you to have that money to pass on to future generations.
I haven't worried about the 95. I don't think.
Yeah.
Okay. Look, thanks very much for the advice.
Yeah, okay, thanks Robert, all the best. 23 past 12 on 2GB, if you have any questions about financial planning or lack of it, 131873 is the number to call, 131873.
Topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information. And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services, high-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
Or give them a call during business hours here in Sydney on 9258 7500, 9258 7500. The website, of course, accessible any time at all, 24/7, ITFS, standing for itfinancialservices.com.au. They can help you get to where you want to go. What you need is the knowledge. What you need is expertise, honed out of years of experience and study. Whether you want to invest, consolidate debt, or manage your own super, IT Financial Services are the people to help you. Their advisors know all the ins and outs. They've been able to help thousands of people meet their financial goals over the years. If you're going it alone, well, you could be throwing your money away. There's no doubt. That's my honest opinion.
We'll get to that later in the evening.
Thank heavens you are there to help the people, and you can help them free right now if they call in on 131873. 131873. Is investing too complex for most people, given that it probably wasn't a subject for most at school unless they did bookkeeping, I suppose?
Yeah, the old commerce course, of course, didn't have anything to do with investing. Really nothing at school, I don't think, unless it's changed in the last few years. Prepares people at all. And the saddest part with that, of course, is that most young people, of course, consider themselves to be bulletproof. They don't need to do anything about planning for the future. And suddenly the future's there. The idea really is for parents, for example, that are out there listening to us tonight, is to encourage your children that have got their first jobs and so on to get themselves a planner at that stage. They shouldn't be waiting until they're 35, 45 or whatever when they've actually got funds to invest.
Mm-hmm.
They should be looking at the issues when they're quite young. And that applies in a lot of cases, particularly things like insurances and so on. For example, if you were 20, 21 or something and you don't own any property and you've got no great debts or whatever, you really don't need insurance in all likelihood.
Mm-hmm.
However, flash forward to Chris's stage in life where they've got a young family, et cetera, they've got a mortgage to pay off, all those sorts of things, which most young people have, then insurance becomes a very, very important part of your planning.
Mm.
So it might be that someone, while they're paying the mortgage off, doesn't have funds to invest, so I won't go to a financial planner.
Yeah.
But they do need to set long-term plans in place, particularly in that insurance area. And even when you go past that stage, we get people coming in for the first time that probably hear us on 2GB, for example, who might be well in their 50s and they've still got very substantial insurance policies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they've paid the mortgage off, the kids are growing up and left home, etc. Why do you then need a very big insurance policy? The answer is you don't anymore, and usually as you get older, they become more expensive as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you quite often reach a stage where we recommend to people to do what we call self-insure, where the assets that they've got behind them are more than enough to provide for the husband and wife in the future, and they own the house already, et cetera, et cetera. So they're better off to, instead of putting $10,000 a year into insurance policies, they're better off to be putting it into their superannuation or other investments.
How risky are reverse mortgages?
Not at this stage. They cleaned up the industry a lot. 10 years ago, there was a lot of bad providers and bad products out there. But now, these days, if you get a reverse mortgage, you'll be 20% of the value of the house. So they'll max it out. Before, they're giving you 50, 60, 70%. But now they'll max it out at 20%. So there's no chance, or very small chance, at the what you have to pay back at the end. So, you know, 20 years' time when you fall off the perch and your son or daughter, they wouldn't have a bill to pay back, because that happened in some of those stages where house prices went down in the 2008, 2009, and what they borrowed was more than what the house is worth.
So if they had a bill to pay back, that's to prevent the house from going.
No,
just to keep the house.
So just say the parents fell off the perch, and then, so they borrowed $500,000, and then the house was only worth $400,000.
Mm.
So the son and daughter had to come up with $100,000 to pay off that asset.
Wow.
But they've cleaned up the industry where they've the maximum you can get out for the reverse mortgage now is 20% of the house value.
Fair enough.
And so if that, over time, hopefully, the house price will increase enough. They've done all the calculations where it should be right now.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back one step with that. Why people do this in the first place. And the reason people take out reverse mortgages and similar products is because they reach a stage where they're cash poor, perhaps in retirement, and by doing that, they unlock 20% of the capital value of their house, as Chris said, and that means that their quality of life is considerably enhanced. Now, a lot of people might be reluctant to do that because they think they're giving away the kids' inheritance, which is the family home. However, that's not necessarily the case at all when you think about it. Say you took out that mortgage 6 or 7 years ago, that 20%. I wonder what your house is worth today compared to what it was 7 years ago. So the actual money that they're going to leave the children when they pass away is far, far greater and is increased at a far greater rate as a result of changing housing prices. So you're not giving away the farm, and you are getting to have a better quality of life for yourself in those years when when you can appreciate it.
Do you find people who come to you maybe a bit later in life have made mistakes, common mistakes, when they were a bit younger?
That's probably the best thing about compulsory superannuation, that whether you like it or not, that 9.5, whatever it is at the moment, is coming out of your wage from your first paycheck when you might be 18, 20, 21, depending on university studies, etc. And so to some degree, at least, people are going to have reasonable amounts. And that comes back to what we were talking about with the ageing population earlier, by the way. That's one of the ways in which the government will be able to prevent some of those problems.
Right.
I hadn't seen statistics for a few years, but the last ones I saw said that you needed to save about 15% of your income going through life, and that you would then be able to retire if they don't change the taxation rules on superannuation. You'd retire then with about the same income as you had while you were working.
Wow. 15%.
15%. And obviously you wouldn't then be reliant in any way on Social Security, et cetera, et cetera, which would make our friends in Canberra very happy.
But a lot of kids apparently are getting into big debt with their mobile phone contracts and stuff like that, and I think their average debt is $20,000.
Yeah.
They're way behind the eight ball on this saving 15% thing.
They're forced to save 9.5 because of compulsory super, so that's a start at least. But you're right. You know? But again, that's the sort of reason why younger people should be getting advice as well as older people.
131873 is our number. The lines are open right now if you have any questions. 131873, call us now. Is the number if you have any questions, and we check the weather. 18 degrees in the city at present. Isn't it beautiful? 4 above average. It's going to be cool in the outer west overnight, down to 8 degrees at Campbelltown and Richmond. A minimum of 10 at Parramatta, Penrith and Liverpool. Down to 11 at Terry Hills, 13 the minimum in the city. And it's going to be sunny and warm and windy today. Wind chill factor -4. But with 24 degrees the maximum, I think we can afford that, and early fog patches in the west. Tomorrow, Tuesday the 15th, will be hot with a possible shower, a city top of 28 degrees. How about that? What a change in just a week. 30% chance of rain, early fog patches in the west, and the slight chance of a shower in the afternoon and evening, and the chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening tomorrow. On Wednesday, it'll be mild and windy with a possible coastal shower. Mild with a shower or two on Thursday, top of 19. Again, mild with showers and 19 degrees on Friday, and ditto on Saturday. So there we are. Make the most of the next couple of days. It's going to be absolutely beautiful. Sometimes people give unqualified financial advice. I did this once when a friend who was worth a fair bit said, oh, he's got this terrific offer where he can earn 50%. Mm-hmm. It was called Willow. It was a pyramid scheme. You might recall Willow's about 20 years ago, where people were just paying the early people in the scheme out of the money that was coming in, making it look as if it was a fair dinkum investment. I said, no, you will lose all your money. He wouldn't listen. He lost all his money.
Of course.
Yeah, big shock.
Ponzi scheme.
Now, I mean, I'm not going to go to jail for giving financial advice like that, am I?
I hope not.
You have to be certified, right? You have to be certified, but that kind of advice, the over-the-back fence advice, that's not where the cops come in, say, you're giving him advice.
No.
Let's see your certificate.
No. Goodness me, that's a good reason to go and get advice.
Oh, absolutely.
I've got a very dear friend, actually, who we sent into retirement with a very, very good portfolio and so on, and he went to live in Thailand. And he got somehow mixed up over there with a group in Malaysia, into a gold scheme, and lo and behold, he was getting 23, 25% on his money for the first 18 months.
Yep.
All gone.
Ah.
Yeah. The old story, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is.
Absolutely. 131873. G'day, Chris. Yes, Chris.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Mate, I'm about 38. I've got a mortgage with two kids.
Mm-hmm.
I've got about $250,000 in my super currently.
Yep.
I'm looking at opening up my self-managed super fund.
Yep.
And maybe buying a house with it.
Yep.
And gaining some rental return on that.
Yep.
What's your thoughts?
The problem that it can be good and it can be bad. So it depends on how much when you're borrowing money in super. Because I assume if you've got 250, that you're looking for something that's...
Yeah, looking at borrowing probably 300,000. I think it's about 5% at the moment.
Yeah. So it's important that you do those calculations and work out. So if you're 300,000, so you're paying back 5%. Your net rental return will probably be around about the 5%. So you're kind of almost breaking even with the costs involved, and it's only going to be the capital growth that could...
Well, capital growth is going to be more than what I'm going to be gaining in interest on my super anyway.
So we're saying, yep, so we're going to be net. So between rental return and what you pay in interest is going to be 0% return, we'll say.
Yep.
But the capital growth... capital growth could be 4%, it could be 10%. We don't know over a longer term. But if it's at 4%, you could almost get that in cash. It's almost risk-free. So that's what you're going to kind of weigh up there. You'd want to be getting 7% or 8% type of thing. So you've got to kind of do the calculations to make sure it's worthwhile.
Yeah, but if you put it over a long period of time, the property value is going to be eventually going up more than what... But it would be staying in the super fund, yeah?
But is there an alternative to that property? So if we're saying property, if wages are increasing at 3 and 3.5%, property prices, I would argue, I think they could only go up at maybe 4%. Otherwise, what you're earning and what you can afford is going in opposite directions. So the long-term property growth is about 3% in Australia type of thing. Over the last couple of years, it's obviously been 10, 15%. There's been years where it's been negative. But to average... You'd want it to average. You need to really work out the calculations, and that's what something we can help you do is work the calculations, because it's a big investment that you're going towards. But it's an Australian thing that we all love property and bricks and mortar. But there, you need to look at the other alternatives as well. If you're buying a property that maybe was $100,000 or half what your super fund is, it can be a good idea. But when you're starting to borrow in your super fund, that's where people can get in trouble.
Okay,
Chris. Just before you go. There's another aspect of this. You mentioned, I think, that you were 38 years old?
Yep.
I'd nearly bet you money that you won't get to your super till you're 65, even though it's 60 at the moment.
Well, they probably want us to work to... Well, they want to work us to 70 now, don't they?
Yeah, well, so you can count on at least 65 before you can touch the super.
Yeah. You're allowed to partially touch it earlier on, aren't you?
They're increasing rules. I think it's 67 now we're allowed to touch it for us. At our age, it's around about 38 it's going to be the changeover, 2035, I think. Joe Hockey announced it last budget or the budget before.
Yeah.
Just, but on that, the point I was going to make to you, Chris, is that you've also got to look at timing with things, right? People will always remember the 87 stock market crash, when in fact in that year in 87, the stock market only dropped 12%. It just went up so much earlier in the year and that looked horrible when it came back down. But in 1990, if I remember correctly, the Sydney residential property market dropped by 30%.
Yep.
30, not 3, 30. So there are times when, for example, if that happened to you, if you bought a property now and it dropped 30%, you'd be a heck of a long time waiting to get the money back.
Yep, but it will bounce back eventually.
Yeah, what I'm saying to you, though, is at 38, you've got time to wait a while.
Yep.
I mean, the property is a cycle, okay? Yep. The prices are as cyclical, and there will be a time when it's going to correct, and I think I'd have your fund set up and probably some, you know, a fair bit of cash and term deposits in there if property's where you really want to go, and perhaps a few good quality shares to just keep your head above water as you wait. And then when there is a correction, that's when I'd be looking at what you're talking about doing, and I think you'll probably do very well.
Yep. Okay.
But I wouldn't be doing it right now.
Only thing is, though, I'm looking at maybe opening up this self-managed super fund soon, because I'm hearing through people that as of next year, the government are going to change the goalposts again and make it very hard for people to start up their own self-managed super fund.
No, I'm not saying don't start your self-managed super fund. You've got enough money in there,
right?
I know
what you're
saying. If you had 100,000 there, I'd say you were nuts, to be quite honest with you, because the costs beat you. Because you have to have a tax return and an audit done on the fund every year, and there's also a statutory government charge. So, but with the balance you've got, it's big enough. The balance you've got is big enough to make it feasible for you.
Yep.
Right? So that you're not going to get beaten by the costs. So if that's where you want to go in the long term, I'd still open the fund soon. I wouldn't wait for the reasons you just said. And but I wouldn't be buying the property in it straight away.
Okay. I could do other means and
For sure.
And wait till later.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, guys, thanks for that.
Okay, lots of luck, Chris. 15.5 to 1 on 2GB. You see properties advertised, you know, $300,000, got good tenants paying $250 a week. Is there a rule of thumb that should be about 10% to be a reasonable investment if you're relying on the renters?
In the Sydney property market, if you get much over 3% rent, you're doing very well.
It's about
okay, so you'd be, if you're that sort of investor, why wouldn't you be buying in Newcastle, where your $1.3 million house costs $400,000 and people are paying maybe $350 rent?
It's because where people are comfortable. It's behavioural. Most people are in Sydney and they want to buy the house next door because that's what they know.
Keep an eye
and
on it. Yeah,
it's definitely not the best way, not necessarily the best way to go. You need to diverse. If you're going to have a property portfolio, you don't want one next to you because you probably already own that property. Maybe get one in a different state or different area, but people like to see and touch. It's kind of the behavioural part of it.
If you were looking around and you said, you know, this is a house and this is the rent that they're paying, is there some amount, looking at the rental amount, where you're thinking the government is paying that? It's affordable housing. In other words, there's no job to lose to throw them out on the street. Like it's like defence housing.
Yes,
Your rental is safe.
Yeah, it's safe. There's the defence housing, there's a lot of costs involved. They probably talk about it in Newcastle where, you know, if the jobs can go a lot easier. In Sydney, it's easier to find another job and you'll get guaranteed rent.
Mm.
That's kind of the only difference I would see. But
there's another perspective. And that is some friends of mine's parents grew up in the down south, around the Tumbarumba area, on the land.
Yeah.
And when Dad got to retirement down there, he actually bought a whole parcel of residential properties in the town, and he was netting something like 10% per annum, because down there you're getting no capital growth, but the houses are so cheap that you still get a reasonable rental. So in that case, it's a different type of investment. You know, thought again. For example, we get people coming in now that are approaching retirement, and they say, "Oh, I'd like to buy an investment unit," and I nearly have a conniption fit, to be quite honest, because the as I said, you'll get somewhere, but in Sydney you'll get about 3-3.5% rents, right? you've got to have a heck of a lot of money in property before you get enough to live on in retirement. And throw on top of that that if you've got the properties outside superannuation, that the rents are going to be taxable anyway. So, you know, for someone who had $1 million in bank shares in their superannuation, for example, mm-hmm. if we look historically, the returns have been around 5%, 6%, 7% yes. over the years on those. And there's been capital growth. But let's forget the capital growth for a minute. But if you had that same $1 million in investment property or investment properties, and you're getting 3%, that's sort of 3.5%, you're getting $30,000 to $35,000 a year. That's a heck of an ordinary return on $1 million of capital invested. Right. Plus, there's no flexibility in it whatsoever when you think about it. You can't sell
you can't reach in and grab some trip overseas.
Whereas you can sell a couple of shares. So, you know, again, it's horses for courses. You know, for younger investors, like the gentleman that rang, the 38-year-old, you know, the sky's the limit. You know, if he wants to go the property direction, I'm sure he'll do well. You know, but for someone who's at retirement age, for example, an investment property in Sydney is the last thing in the world I'd ever suggest that people buy. Last thing.
Note this well, folks. Hope you're taking notes. There'll be an exam at the end of the year. 12 to 1 on 2GB. Back in a moment.
Topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information. And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services, high-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
Our number 131873 if you have any questions about your financial plans or lack of financial planning. 131873. Now, we've got some pretty warm days coming up today and tomorrow. 18 in town and present. 24 degrees the top today, up to around 26 or 27 in the west. You'll think it's summer. And it'll be windy. In the city, a wind chill factor of -4. It shouldn't bother you. Tomorrow, Tuesday, the city maximum will be 28 degrees, with a slight chance of a shower in the afternoon and evening and the chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening tomorrow. So there you go. Then milder weather arrives on Wednesday, 20 degrees, with a possible coastal shower, and it'll be windy, mild, with a few showers Thursday, Friday and Saturday. And if you want to know more about IT Financial Services, go to their website anytime at all, ITFS, standing for IT Financial Services, and .com.au. Simple as that, itfs.com.au. Or make a note to call them during business hours later today on 9258 7500. If you really want to turn your financial dreams into reality, you have to take action. And the first step is to gain the right financial knowledge, and that's where IT Financial Services can help you so much. They work with you, taking you through the steps that you need to get where you want to go, whether you want to invest, consolidate debt, manage your own super, whether you're just starting off in your working life, or whether you're approaching retirement, or perhaps already retired. The good folk at IT Financial Services can really be of assistance to you. So make a note of their number, Sydney 9258 7500. 9258 7500. Or visit their website anytime at all, itfs.com.au. Now, can a computer do your financial planning for you, Ian? Chris?
So in the US, they've got something called robo-advice. So it's been there for about 3 or 4 years, and on Friday, NAB just launched theirs. Commonwealth are coming out with theirs, and it's going to be come out in Australia with the rest of the banks as well. So what it is, it's basically a computer generating what you should do with your money and your insurances and your debt, etc., etc. So it's when you log on to your online banking, you fill out a little questionnaire, and it'll tell you, okay, do this, this, and this, and this, and that. There's some good parts and some bad parts about it. I think the good part is that it's an easy way to, you can see a financial planner, get some basic financial advice, and kind of set you on the right track. The bad part they found out in America through their studies is that when the market, like the share market's gone down a little bit in the last month or so, but people panic, they're not speaking to anyone, and they're selling out all, they're selling out all their investments. And that's a bad thing to do. It's very behavioural. So when the market goes up, when the property market goes up, everyone wants to buy a property. Or when the share market goes up, everyone wants to buy shares. But when it goes down, everyone wants to scatter. But that, obviously, it's the reverse way that you should go about it. So they're talking about using the robo-advice, look, it's going to be good for some people in the beginning, but if you've got a greater deal of money, it's better to, I think, better to see someone and talk to someone about your, the big lifestyle decisions that you've got. They say it's not going to replace a good planner. It's going to replace the product floggers. So what the banks are trying to do is they've got all these products they want to sell you, and they're trying to, these computer programs will place you into some of their other products. Advisors that just provide that kind of basic advice, that's going to hurt them as well. But a good advisor that's going to look at your whole situation and talk you through the different areas and your lifestyle, there's just some stuff where a computer can't go that a human face-to-face contact will be able to go.
Mm-hmm. Just to add to that slightly, one of the things that amused me, and I'm not supposed to be amused by those things, is the profiling that's done with people. So the idea of you'd feed in all sorts of details into this questionnaire thing on your computer, and it'll give you a mark out of 10, which will be your risk profile. In other words, whether you're a madman who wants to have Penny Dreadful shares only, or whether you want to dig a hole in the backyard and put your money in a jam tin. So there's two ends to that spectrum. But most of the work we do, I find, and for example, most of the people that come into the office that are retiring don't own any shares. I mean, they've got shares inside their superannuation because they're in superannuation, but they've never owned shares. They don't really understand markets.
Except for NRMA.
Yes.
And AMP and a couple of the others.
They forgot about those shares.
And even then there were scams out there, so the people were selling those shares far, far more cheaply than they were actually worth. And because they didn't know any better.
Mm.
Yeah, people got hold of the share registries and, not a good situation.
But right.
Never replace the human touch.
Absolutely. And that's what IT Financial Services will provide, the human touch and a great deal of experience. Gentlemen, we've been caught by the affliction of time. Thank you very much for coming in. Have a great week, and we'll see one or both of you same time, same station next week.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Bye for now.